powers who made most of the running at the event. Although the anti-Semitism that had run through the conference was downplayed in the final document, it took it as proven that there was no wrong in the world that could not be laid at the West's doors. Every endlessly rehearsed crime of the West was used as the sole explainer for global racism and discrimination. Any and all negative aspects of life in Africa, the Middle East, the Far East and elsewhere were either ignored or put on the West's tab, regardless. For instance, the final declaration at Durban pronounced, "We recognize that colonialism has led to racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and related intolerance." It claimed that the African people still suffer the consequences, and that not only should colonialism be condemned, but its reoccurrence should be prevented. Something that African leaders notably failed to do over the following two decades as they sold their countries to China's Belt and Road project. Elsewhere, the declaration condemned the transatlantic slave trade, the only such slave trade that was singled out and named. It also called for reparations to be made by the countries that were responsible for these atrocities. In some ways, these conclusions were mild, given the nature of the conference that had led up to the final document. Because there had been many highlights in the anti-Western frenzy that was the Durban conference. For instance, there was the sight of Robert Mugabe's government, then terrorizing and murdering white farmers in Zimbabwe, calling on Britain and America to apologize unreservedly for their crimes against humanity. Someone called Matthew Kuhn-Kum, a chief of Canada's First Nations, told the UN delegates that he and his fellow natives were victims of a racist and colonial syndrome of dispossession and discrimination. This went down very well with the delegates. When Mr. Kuhn-Kum claimed that the government in Ottawa had only a year before ordered white mobs to attack the people of the First Nations, a figment of Mr. Kuhn-Kum's imagination, the delegates applauded loudly. Of course, the government being accused of these crimes had paid for Mr. Kuhn-Kum's airfare to go to Durban and make these allegations against the Canadian authorities. But this irony had to join a long queue at Durban. The Syrian foreign minister was among the other progressives who used the conference to make their pitch against the West for its xenophobia and prejudice. The term techno-racism was invented at the conference to try to claim that capitalism was in its essence a racist enterprise. The biggest ovation of all was reserved for Fidel Castro, who was introduced to the conference as the leader of the most democratic country in the world. By 2001, Castro had neglected to hold a free and democratic election in Cuba for four decades. But that did not matter to the attendees at Durban. In fact, nothing mattered to them other than attacking the Western democracies, blaming them for all the world's ills, and lauding anyone seen as an enemy or antagonist of the West. Perhaps the only meaningful disagreement at Durban came over who the reparations should be paid to. Various African-American attendees thought that reparations should be paid to individuals, whereas, as Mark Stein observed at the time, the African presidents in attendance seemed to believe that it would be more convenient if the West just dropped off one big check at the presidential palace. There was even a moment when the Organization of African Unity stated that reparations for the slaughter of the Tutsi tribe by the Hutu tribe in Rwanda in 1994 should be paid out by the government of America. Rwanda gained its independence from Belgium in 1962. Anyone familiar with the operation of the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva will be familiar with this system of values. There, Israel, America, and the European powers are consistently berated for historic crimes by such luminaries of human rights as Iran, Syria, and Venezuela. Most of this can be put down to posturing and distraction techniques, as it was in 2020, when North Korea called the United States a human rights wasteland and a country of extreme racists, citing the BLM protests and the death of George Floyd as justification. It is hard to imagine a country anywhere in the world in which racism is as instilled into the general population as it is in North Korea. As I saw for myself on a visit to the country some years ago, the idea of the racial supremacy of the North Korean peoples is instilled from birth, as is a racialized contempt for Americans, Westerners in general, the Japanese, and many others. It is a country that actively fears miscegenation and has gone to extraordinary lengths to ensure that North Korean blood is not diluted. International bodies such as the Human Rights Council are perfect places for oppressive states to deflect attention from their own ongoing crimes and focus instead on the historic sins of the West. Most totalitarian, and even many non-aligned countries, find it useful to cover for each other's abuses in this manner. But just because some claims for reparations are cynical and opportunistic, does not mean that all of them are. In recent years, in America in particular, there has been a serious and growing call for some form of reparations to be paid, and it should be seriously considered. These include calls for reparations for the descendants of the victims of empire, and reparations for the descendants of those who suffered from the transatlantic slave trade. For many years, these ideas sat on the Fanon-ish edges of the far left. They were regarded as unfeasible, and so hardly worth discussing seriously. Then, in 2014, Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote a cover article for The Atlantic called The Case for Reparations, that made a serious argument for a historic wealth transfer from one set of racial groups in society to another. In his 15,000-word essay, Coates claimed, "Something more than moral pressure calls America to reparations. We cannot escape our history." The history that particularly calls for reparations was the existence of slavery and the Jim Crow laws. His claim was that because black Americans still underperform white Americans in household income, this inequity could be put down to the legacy of racism in the United States. On the point that he did raise, Coates was wildly imprecise about exactly how any such reparation transaction could be carried out. He even claimed that he didn't think that reparations could be achieved. But the essay changed the weather around the discussion. In fact, 5 years later, The New Yorker said that the article had changed the world, not least by making reparations a major subject of debate among Democratic presidential candidates. Portions of the left across the West also picked up the theme. In a short time, the subject of reparations moved from being politically unfeasible to politically credible. In Britain, the 2019 Labour Party manifesto committed Her Majesty's opposition to conduct an audit of the impact of Britain's colonial legacy. The resulting 234-page investigation into the British state, published by the Labour Party in 2021, declared that Britain should make an unreserved apology to all of the countries of the world that the empire invaded and negatively impacted, and that the British state should set up a reparations fund to communities across the world that can show loss and detriment as a result of the actions of the British state. In America, the issue came even closer to the political centre, and it makes the demands of the British Labour Party look straightforward. For it is in the United States that the talk of a wealth transfer is not about an international money transfer, but a transfer of wealth from one set of racial groups within the country to another. The Democratic contenders for the presidential nomination in 2020 talked about it. And one of President Biden's first acts in office in February 2021 was to give his support to Democratic lawmakers attempting to pass legislation that would create a commission to examine slavery in the United States and its ongoing effects and to look into possible remedies. The possible remedies listed included financial payments from the government to the descendants of slaves to compensate them for unpaid labour carried out by their ancestors. Wittingly or otherwise, such people and US authorities are dealing with a question deeper than they realise. In his Atlantic piece on reparations, Ta-Nehisi Coates talked about German reparations to Israel as a type of model for what reparations might look like in the United States. Since he, too, chose to employ a World War II parallel, perhaps a tale from the same period might be used to exemplify the depth of the problem that any discussion about reparations must deal with. In 1969, the Holocaust survivor and celebrated post-war Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal published a work called The Sunflower, on the possibilities and limits of forgiveness. It is an account of something that Wiesenthal says happened to him at the Lemberg concentration camp. In 1943, Wiesenthal was one of a group of forced labourers and one day is plucked from the line and taken to the bedside of a Nazi soldier who is dying. The man, called Karl S. in the book, turns out to have joined the Hitler Youth and from there moved up the Nazi ranks all the way to the SS. During this time, he participated in one particular atrocity. He confesses to the Jewish man at his bedside that his unit had at one stage in the war destroyed a house in which there were around 300 Jews. The SS unit had set the house on fire, and as the Jews inside tried to escape from the burning building by leaping from the windows, Karl S. and his comrades shot and killed them all. This is described in considerable detail, and if this was all the Sunflower was, then it would simply be yet one more tale of the countless number of tales of Nazi atrocities carried out against Jews during World War II. But Wiesenthal's book is not about that. It is about what happens next. Because it is clear that Karl has asked for a Jew to be brought to his bedside because he wants to confess to this crime in particular, and to a Jew in particular. Because he wants to get this particular atrocity off his chest before his imminent death. It is something in the way of a deathbed confession. And it is what happens next that makes Wiesenthal's book so memorable. For, after the SS soldier has finished his tale, and the reader perhaps expects some type of reconciliation, Wiesenthal gets up and leaves the room without saying a word. Later, Wiesenthal meditates on whether he did the right thing, and the second half of the book is given over to a symposium involving a range of thinkers and religious leaders who contributed their thoughts on the events that Wiesenthal has described. It is noticeable, incidentally, that many of the Christians who contributed to this symposium believed that Wiesenthal should have offered some kind of forgiveness to the soldier. But the broader consensus that emerges from the contributors is that Wiesenthal did the right thing. And if there is a reason that this comes down to, it is this: that Wiesenthal, although he was a Jew, like the soldier's victims, had neither the right nor the ability to forgive the soldier for what he had done. In order for true forgiveness to occur, the parties involved must be not only the one who has done the wrong, but the one to whom the wrong has been done. Wiesenthal may have been a Jew like the victims, but he does not have the right to forgive on behalf of his fellow Jews who were gunned down by the soldier as they jumped from a burning building. Wiesenthal is not these men, women, and children. He is not even a close relative of these men, women, and children. These victims may never have wanted to forgive their killers. Perhaps they would have hated their killers forever and not wanted them to die in peace. The SS soldier had participated in such a terrible end for them. So what right did Wiesenthal have to say on behalf of all of these people that the SS soldier is forgiven? Why should the SS soldier die with even a part of his conscience cleared? After taking no care about the consciences of so many other human beings. Within this is a very powerful and important point, almost totally lost in the debate about forgiveness in the modern world. In recent years, the prime ministers of countries including Australia, Canada, the United States, and Britain have all issued apologies for historic wrongs. Sometimes, as when the direct victims of these wrongs are still alive, this can ameliorate suffering and provide a form of closure for the victims. But when we are talking about apologies for things done centuries ago, we enter a different ethical territory. In such cases, neither the people claiming to be victims nor the people assuming the mantle of perpetrators are any such thing. When it comes to apologies for the slave trade or for colonialism, we are talking about political leaders and others making apologies for things that happened before they themselves were born, and apologizing to people who have not suffered these wrongs themselves, though some may be able to point to some disadvantage they can claim to have suffered as a result of these historic actions. Any apology begins to consist of people who may or may not be descended from people who may have done some historic wrong, apologizing to people who may or may not be descended from people who had some wrong done to them. In the realm of reparations, this becomes messier still. For at this stage, the divide in the West is by no means clearly between victims and perpetrators. Whereas the governments in almost every non-Western country are strikingly ethnically homogeneous, consider the political leadership in India, China, or South Africa, governments in every Western country are now made up of people of a wide variety of ethnic backgrounds. No Western cabinet would be able to work out the victim-oppressor divide even at the table around which they sit. Nor would any political party. Just consider the difficulty merely of working out what Elizabeth Warren may or may not be owed. The issue of reparations now comes down not to descendants of one group paying money to descendants of another group. Rather, it comes down to people who look like the people to whom a wrong was done in history, receiving money from people who look like the people who may have done the wrong. It is hard to imagine anything more likely to rip apart a society than attempting a wealth transfer based on this principle. Perhaps that is why the difficult questions on this are ignored by everybody who has argued for reparations to occur. For instance, were any such scheme to operate in America, the country would have to carefully determine which racial groups in the country have been most harmed by American history. It may determine to limit the scope of its attention solely to the issue of people who are the descendants of slaves, though there is no reason why it should limit itself to that. But if it did, then the prelude to reparations would have to be the development of a societal genetic database. It could be that this would only be necessary to create for the black population of the United States. It would then have to determine how to apportion the funds available. Anyone who thinks voter ID laws or vaccines are intrusive should prepare for the questions that will follow this process. For instance, after the genetic database is created, it will have to be decided whether or not the only recipients should be those who are 100% descended from slaves, if any such people can be identified. Should these people alone be given a full stipend? Should someone who is only descended from slaves on their mother's side receive 50% of the same sum? Will the restitution process try to operate the one-drop rule? And if so, how will it ensure that nobody is taking advantage of the financial spigots that would result? And of course, all of this would be predicated on the idea that a vast wealth transfer from one racial group to another racial group in America in the 2020s will bring racial harmony and will not cause any igniting or resurgence of racial ill feeling. Can anyone be sure that this is the most likely result? Only around 14% of the US population is black. As of 2019, more than half of that population, 59%, were millennials or younger, that is, under the age of 38. During their lifetime, it has been illegal to treat people differently because of their skin color. Jim Crow laws were decades in the past before this group was born. The official prohibition on the further importing of slaves into the United States had been signed 2 centuries before this group was born. To begin to apply reparations to this community would require a clear differentiation between black Americans who are descendants of Africans brought forcibly to the United States and black Americans whose ancestors voluntarily came to the United States in the centuries after slavery was abolished. And what about the people doing the paying? There will be many people who have come to America's shores since slavery ended, most of America's Jewish, Asian, and Indian populations, for instance, who may make an objection at this point. Why should those whose ancestors played no part in a wrong be made to forfeit a part of their tax dollars in paying for something that happened generations before their family came to America? Should people whose ancestors died in the Civil War fighting for the North get any special dispensation? Should those whose ancestors fought for the South pay disproportionately more? There are very obvious reasons why people might call for reparations, for political convenience, or in genuinely seeking to right a historic wrong. But there is an equally obvious reason why they can almost never be drawn into giving any details of what the process might look like. That is because it is an organizational and ethical nightmare. We also know that no matter how much is done to address the issue, it will never be enough. We know this not least because Britain's attempt to make up for the slave trade is over 2 centuries in the past, and the issue of further reparations being made is still raised. Indeed, the subject is discussed as though critics either do not know or know, and do not care, how many resources Britain poured into abolishing slavery in the 1800s. The British taxpayer paid a hefty price for the abolition of the slave trade for almost half a century, and it has been proven that British taxpayers spent almost as much suppressing the slave trade for 47 years as the country profited from it in the half century before slavery was abolished, meaning that the costs to the taxpayer of abolition in the 19th century were almost certainly greater than the benefits that came in the 18th century. The British government of the day spent 40% of the entire national budget to buy freedom for the people who had been enslaved. At the time, the only way that the British government could get the consensus needed to abolish the trade was to compensate those companies that had lost income because of the trade. This sum was so large that it was not finally paid off until 2015. And while some campaigners have used this to show how recent the trade in human beings was, it rather better exemplifies the unprecedented lengths the government was willing to go to in order to end this vile trade. Two of the scholars who have done some of the complex math required here have estimated that the cost of abolition to British society was just under 2% of national income, and that was the case for 60 years, from 1808 to 1867. Factoring in the principal costs and the secondary costs, for instance, the higher prices for goods that the British had to pay throughout this period, Britain's suppression of the Atlantic slave trade, it has been claimed, constituted the most expensive example of international moral action recorded in modern history. Several things could be learned from this, but one thing worth noting is that such actions appear in the current era to be almost entirely unknown. What is more, they appear to buy Britain and the wider West absolutely no time off in the purgatory of the present. The British may have actually overpaid in compensation for their involvement in the slave trade, but it appears to count as nothing. Demands for reparations internationally and domestically still continue. Is there any end to this? Are there even any means to an end to this? The British precedent suggests not. If America were to find a way to pay reparations today, why would the same demands not re-arise 2 centuries later, as they have done in relation to Britain? If the great reparations machine were to pour out money, why should it be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity? It is not a problem that is unique to the British or American examples. Whenever a country such as Greece gets into financial trouble, politicians there can always be found who are willing to say that Germany must pay Greece for its occupation of the country during World War II. Indeed, Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras made precisely this demand again in 2015. There are not many ways to see how this would stop, other than Greece never getting into financial difficulties ever again. The same applies to the payment of reparations for empire or slavery. It will always be the case that there will be African politicians who will claim that the problems of their country are not to do with any mismanagement of their own, but because of colonialism. The late Robert Mugabe was a fine example of this genre. The only way for such demands to stop would be for every former colony to be thriving and well-run for the rest of time, with governments that are always and everywhere strangers to corruption. Likewise, in the American context, what would it look like for reparations to have been paid off. Even writers such as Coates, who have argued for reparations, have joked about the likely consequences of doling out large sums of money to black Americans. Dave Chappelle did a skit on this, showing black people spending their reparations payments on fancy cars, rims, clothes, and more. It would be a good time to buy shares in Nike. But the serious fact is that it could only be deemed that reparations had worked if black Americans either performed equally to or actually outperformed all other racial groups. And not just in the aftermath of payments, but for every year in the foreseeable future. If black Americans underperformed, then it could always be argued that reparations had not so far adequately occurred because inequalities still existed. In order for demands for reparations to go away, any and all wealth disparities would have to disappear, not just once, but forever. Until then, it is hard to see how the demands for financial compensation will be able to stop. In the meantime, it is impossible not to note how fantastically one-sided, ill-informed, and hostile this debate has become. No world forum ever concentrates seriously on any form of reparations that does not involve the West. And there is an obvious reason why there are no calls for reparations to Africans abducted into the slave trade that went east, which is that the Arabs deliberately killed off the millions of Africans they bought. But there is little explanation as to why it is that today it is only Western former colonial powers or former slave-owning countries that are expected to pay any sort of compensation for sins of two centuries ago. Modern Turkey is not expected to pay money for the activities of the Ottoman Empire, an empire that, incidentally, ran on for twice as long as the empires of Europe did. After all these years, it is still only the sins of the West that the world, including much of the West, wish to linger over. It is as though, when looking at the many multivariant problems that exist in the world, a single patina of answers has been provided that is meant to explain every problem and provide every answer. In 2021, during a discussion with, among others, a black American filmmaker and a prominent black media academic from South Africa, I was told by the latter that we live in a white supremacist patriarchal society. I asked Asanda Ngoesheng, whose work was described as focusing on the decolonization of the curriculum and attempts to amplify conversation about race, power, and gender, what we meant in this context. My counterpart was living in and speaking from South Africa. That country has certainly had its own uniquely benighted history. If you had said that South Africa under apartheid was a white supremacist society, then you would have been correct. But, I asked my colleague, did she honestly mean to claim that the whole world, including South Africa today, is a white supremacist society? Yes, she said, that is what I am saying. And she added, not just in South Africa, but globally. And I wondered in what sense it can possibly be said that today's South Africa, a country whose cabinet is entirely composed of black South Africans, is a white supremacist society. The country certainly has its own wide array of problems, but white supremacy seems to me not to be among them. I was told that as a white non-South African, I had no right to say that South Africa today is not a white supremacist society. Minutes earlier, the same person had felt free to tell me that Britain is the home of racism. Not for the first time, I marvelled at the fact that generalizations about the West remain the only generalizations acceptable to make, whereas specific questions about specific claims made about non-Western countries are batted away as though they could not possibly contain any merit and are, in fact, presumptuous even to raise. What is anyone from the West, let alone a white person from the West, to do in such a setup? To date, only a few options have been made available. One is to raise the next generation of people in the West with a sense that they are the heirs of an illegitimate, ill-gotten fortune. That, to the extent that they have any benefits in their lives, these benefits have been dishonestly accrued in a uniquely wicked way. This seems to be the option employed by an increasing number of institutions, particularly in Australia, Canada, and America. In the summer of 2020, when the COVID crisis was still ongoing and university education continued to be disrupted, first-year students everywhere began the process of getting heavily in debt. Most were doing so virtually. At the University of Connecticut, first-year students were greeted by a set of online events. At one of these events, the students were instructed to download an app to their phones. This app asked students to type in their home address. The app then informed them which Native American tribe their home had been stolen from. So that is one way to do it. To imbue people with an endless sense of unalleviable guilt and shame. Another option is to try to alleviate or otherwise pay down that guilt. But how to do it? In her book on white privilege, the black British broadcaster and writer June Sarpong, who is a deeply privileged person herself, has suggested a number of actions that white people can take. One is to educate yourself about the past. Black History Month is not enough, according to Sarpong. Instead, she says, black history should be taught 365 days of the year. What more can white people do? Sarpong writes, first, you can look to fill the gaps left by an incomplete teaching of black history from your own education, such as the British Empire, she suggests. More importantly, she tells people that they can lend support and make cash donations to a number of black groups she names. Finally, white people should lobby their politicians to remove statues and monuments to people who should not in the 21st century be venerated. But even this is only so long as you remember that there are bigger battles than statues that need to be fought and won if we are to defeat systemic racism once and for all. Otherwise, it may be possible to arrive at equality by giving non-Western people a freer pass and carrying out acts of vengeance on Western people. Arlington County's attorney recently said that she plans to find ways to reduce the incarceration of black people by explicitly taking race into account in prosecutorial decision-making. The former chief prosecutor has condemned this, saying that it makes a mockery of blind justice and corrodes confidence in the criminal justice system, which, indeed, it does. Parisa Degani-Taft appears to be keen to ensure that any past wrongs are righted by creating fresh wrongs. Others also see this as a route to justice. In 2020, San Francisco passed the Karen Act, which made it a hate crime to make a racially motivated 911 call against a black person without reasonable suspicion of a crime. The name comes from the derogatory term Karen, which in recent years has come to mean a white woman with entitled energy. The act makes it a potential crime to call the cops on a person who is black and makes white people doing so have to wonder whether it will be they who the police take in for questioning. It is also noteworthy, in passing, that in the current era, racial slurs are actually cool and can be written into law so long as the people they demean are white women. Both of these actions in Arlington and San Francisco are explicit departures from the 14th Amendment's guarantee of equal protection of the laws. Both take the form of explicitly unequal treatment on the basis of race. Taking this further would certainly be one form of revenge, if not reparation. But a grander, more common form of revenge is what is now taking place and sweeping across the culture. This process carries forward one of the central claims of those who attacked Western civ courses in America in the 1980s, which is that the best and easiest form of revenge is to trash the entire Western canon and tradition. There are various ways to do this, but the one that has become popular in recent decades is to lambast the Western tradition for failing to take into account or otherwise integrate the experience of outside voices, making it effectively worthless. This movement claims that marginalized groups were never allowed into the Western pantheon, and that it has always been hermetically sealed for bigoted reasons. It claims that a tradition that started with Plato and Socrates could have no understanding of same-sex attraction. That a history that included Helen of Troy, Sappho, the Madonna, Jane Austen, and Marie Curie had no place for women. Most importantly, it asserts that Western history, instead of being almost incomparably outward-looking and diverse, is in fact a tradition that is historically insular and exclusionary. From this wholesale attack on Western history, it can be seen that every discovery made by the West, whether it is the discovery of new lands or the discovery of the atom bomb, can be used against it. As though it were obvious that had any other group of people got there first, the results would have been more peaceful, equal, and socially just. There is no evidence whatsoever for this. Indeed, there is a great amount of evidence that things would have gone far worse and more bloodily had the West not been first in a whole range of discoveries. Still, it seems that it is not enough to attack the West merely by attacking every aspect of its history. It is also necessary to attack every other aspect of its inheritance. That includes its religious and philosophical pillars. In an effort to pretend that one of the richest traditions on earth is in fact deserving of nothing but destruction. The tools being used to carry out this act of revenge will by now be very familiar. Chapter 3. Religion. In 2012, a few years before he was attacked in London for being white, General Jim Allen was in Afghanistan. To be precise, he was on television across the country in which he was stationed, appealing to the noble people of Afghanistan. A serious incident had arisen in the country. For it had been rumoured, not confirmed, just rumoured, that some Muslim holy books, including Qurans, had been improperly disposed of at a US airbase north of Kabul. For the time being, nobody knew exactly what had happened, but riots were already starting, extremist clerics were getting their boots on, and the world's press was gearing up or battening down for a major Quran desecration story. We are thoroughly investigating the incident and are taking steps to ensure this does not ever happen again, General Allen promised, with an unmistakable note of pleading. Swearing that there was nothing intentional in the actions, he promised that as soon as Allied forces had learned of these actions, we immediately intervened and stopped them. He announced that the materials recovered will be properly handled by appropriate religious authorities. You may be critical of the general or praise him for that speech. It may have been supplicating. It may have been supplicating, or it may have been diplomatic. What nobody could say was that the era was capable of ignoring a reported Quran burning. Wherever in the world Qurans were reported to have been disrespected, riots and much more reliably followed. In 2010, when a whack-job Florida pastor threatened to burn a Quran, there was an intervention from General David Petraeus himself. In other words, there was nothing overblown about General Allen's fears. By contrast, in August 2020, at least one Bible, possibly more, was burned on camera in Portland, Oregon. At first, the American news media decided that this was a non-event. Then, some claimed that the reports were actually Russian disinformation. The details of what happened in Oregon after midnight on August the 1st are much disputed. At least one Bible was seen being burned in footage streamed on a live feed on the platform Ruptly. The story immediately went round the world. The idea that a Bible burning should have been one of the features of what had become nightly Antifa protests in America was at least suggestive to a lot of national and international commentators. Certainly, and inevitably, some Russian megaphone sites took up the cause. It was only at this stage that the New York Times and others began to write up the story to highlight how Russian-backed news websites aimed to fuel grievances and deepen political divisions. Several prominent Republicans had tweeted about the story, at least one claiming that a stack of Bibles had been burned. But, as the New York Times wrote, the truth was far more mundane. A few protesters among the many thousands appear to have burned a single Bible and possibly a second for kindling to start a bigger fire. So, nothing really to see here. It is quite the contrast to that. On the one hand, if there is even a rumour anywhere on the globe of the mishandling of an Islamic holy book, the top brass of the American military immediately pronounces a DEFCON 1 situation. But if a Bible is burned in an American city, the country's paper of record says there's nothing to see here because it was only a couple of Bibles and, besides, they were only being used as kindling. Of course, it is true that Muslim communities around the world can be more combustible around these issues than the average Christian or post-Christian societies any longer are. It serves as a reminder that the West is now willing to protect and revere almost any holy places, so long as they are not its own. In part, this is because of the historic fall-off in affiliation with the Christian churches in the last generation. In the United Kingdom, church attendance fell by more than half in the last 40 years, while the number of Americans who identified themselves as Christians fell by over 12% in the last decade alone. The same trend can be seen across every country in the Western world. And where there are any anomalous rises or even plateaus of Christian belief, this maintenance is nearly always the result of immigrant communities. The withdrawing of Christianity is one of the most significant stories of the last century in the West, affecting nearly all its major institutions and populations. You may deplore or celebrate that, but the fact is undeniable. Still, it is not the case that the resulting gap is left vacant. Into that gap, many religions and pseudo-religions have flooded. As Christianity has withdrawn, so one new religion in particular has found its way into the cultural mainstream, starting off in America and flooding out from there across the Western world. It is what the linguistics teacher from Columbia University, John McWhorter, has called the new religion of anti-racism. This new belief system has much in common with that of other religions in history and is, as McWhorter has written, a profoundly religious movement in everything but terminology. It has an original sin, white privilege. It has a judgment day, coming to terms with race. And it has the excommunication of the heretic, social media shamings, and more. Like those of all new faiths, the followers of the religion of anti-racism look with scorn on the main belief system that existed in their society before them. They regard it as barbaric and unenlightened. They look down on those who have not joined their group of the elect, especially those who they believe have seen what they have seen and yet come to different conclusions. Crucially, this new religion constitutes something to do. With any and all other grand narratives collapsed, the religion of anti-racism fills people with purpose and a sense of meaning. It gives them drive and allows them to see where they are going. It allows them to imagine a perfectible upland toward which they and everyone else on earth might strive. It imbues them with confidence and consolation, dividing the society they are in between saints and sinners in a way that gives them the illusion of great perception. Perhaps most crucially, it also allows them to war on what were their own origins. The appeal of this conflict should not be underestimated. It is a very deep-seated instinct, the instinct to destroy, to burn, and to spit on everything that has produced you. And of course, there is one final appeal. The opportunity to treat other people badly, beneath the guise of doing good. Still, it is remarkable that a new religion believes not just that it owes nothing to its origins, but that its origins are in fact part of the problem. There is a reading of social justice theory and anti-racism that could grow out of the Western traditions, not least from Western Christianity. A true social justice movement might recognize these traditions as having given birth to its own self, and continue looking to the traditions of anti-racism, anti-colonialism, and anti-slavery within the Christian heritage. They might even look to such traditions to give answers for ways out of whatever predicaments people currently find themselves in, seeing them as holding out a store of wisdom and knowledge that could be worth drawing upon now, as people have drawn upon them in the past. Yet this is exactly what followers of the new religion do not do. The West's sources, the traditions of Athens and Jerusalem, are in fact the last place that the new devout would look to for guidance or consolation. And that is not entirely a surprise. A strange pattern reappears here, something that is itself a long-standing element of the Western mind. That is a willingness to celebrate and sanctify anything so long as it is not part of the Western tradition, and to venerate anything else in the world so long as it is not part of your own heritage. It is the trend that leads young Americans and Europeans to travel the world to find the temples of the Far East while failing to spend any time in the cathedrals on their own doorsteps. Sometimes this manifests as a simple admiration of the exotic. Sometimes it comes across as a form of loathing for Western society itself. Certainly, it has a long and distinguished tradition. In his Sermon of the 50, 1762, Voltaire performed a masterly attack on what he saw as the contradictions, absurdity, and evident untruth of the Christian religion. Of other faiths, however, he took a different view. His essay On the Manner and Spirit of Nations, 1756, considers the religion of Islam and finds its teachings to be beautiful and admirable in their simplicity. A similar trail has passed through Western thought for centuries. It exists not only in an exaltation of other religious traditions. Most often, it exerts itself by using other peoples and cultures as a way to show how lacking in admirable traits we are in the West. As Edward Said showed, it is not just easy, but rewarding to survey 5 centuries of Western thought and claim that it has always been dominated solely by a sense of superiority or superciliousness toward other cultures. But at least as clear has been a Western tradition of venerating, indeed idealizing, any culture, so long as it is not Western. Though, naturally, this creates an ideal that nobody could possibly live up to. The first explorers who studied the cultures of the countries they stumbled upon very often saw the natives in exactly this light. Indeed, they viewed them as so enviable that they often saw them as living in something like Eden. Christopher Columbus himself described the tribes he first met in the Caribbean in exactly this way, as living like Adam and Eve. Such tribes seemed to be living in paradise, and Europeans were as likely to view them with awe and envy as anything else. That was certainly the case with Louis-Antoine de Bougainville when he came across the men and women of Polynesia in the 18th century. All this played into what is clearly a deep-seated need in human beings, to think of a place that is unspoiled, to believe that a place exists where all is peace and where the woes and struggles of civilization can be escaped. But the Western mind did not just idealize such societies. It consistently used them in order to lambast Western societies for their failures. At times, this took an almost comic form. For instance, in his 1516 work, De Orbe Novae, Peter Martyr d'Anghiera, a humanist and prelate, compared the Spanish conquistadors with extraordinary negativity to the people they encountered in the New World. D'Anghiera criticized the Spanish for their greed, for their cruelty, and for their intolerance. By comparison, the natives were to be admired and in many ways envied. D'Anghiera asserted that, among other things, they go naked. They know neither weights nor measures, nor that source of all misfortunes, money. Living in a golden age, without laws, without lying judges, without books, satisfied with their life, and in no wise solicitous for the future. They lived, he thought, in the Golden Age. As time went on, it became clear that Western writers did not even have to travel to other places in order to compare them favourably against their own. In his famous essay On the Cannibals, circa 1580, Michel de Montaigne, one of the most educated and cultured men in history, relayed what he had been told about people beyond Europe's shores, specifically about tribes who had been accused of cannibalism. I find, from what has been told to me, that there is nothing savage or barbarous about those peoples, but that every man calls barbarous anything he is not accustomed to. It is indeed the case that we have no other criterion of truth or right reason than the example and form of the opinions and customs of our own country. There we always find the perfect religion, the perfect polity, the most developed and perfect way of doing anything. That may have been true in Montaigne's day, but it was not true for much longer in the West. As the centuries went on, a different trend emerged. Whatever were the opinions and customs of the West, these were the worst. Whatever the religion of your own society, this was the worst. What Montaigne asserted became exactly inverted in the centuries after his death, and it was, in part, because of an oddity he expressed in that same essay. At one point, Montaigne said of cannibal tribes, "We surpass them in every kind of barbarism. Their warfare is entirely noble and magnanimous. It has as much justification and beauty as that human malady allows. They are still in that blessed state of desiring nothing beyond what is ordained by their natural necessities. For them, anything further is merely superfluous." That is quite the claim to make, that even the warfare of other people is entirely noble and magnanimous. Yet, repeatedly, the philosophers of the West, some of the most cultured and culturally enlightened people of their day, made similar claims whenever they had the chance. Other societies provided a blank slate onto which could be written all the habits, manners, and virtues that were seen as lacking in the West. Nobody excelled in this habit quite so much as Jean-Jacques Rousseau, a man of extraordinary learning and skill. There was nothing he could not develop a theory on, especially whenever he had no first-hand knowledge of the issue in question. For instance, while Rousseau himself never travelled in far-off countries, he had many theories about the people who lived in them. Specifically, he believed that they lived in a state of nature in which all men were essentially equal. This is one of the most important themes in his influential Discourse on Inequality, 1755. In the state of nature, people do not have the troubles that they have in places such as Rousseau's home societies of Switzerland and France. At the same time, Rousseau was wise enough to know that he was indulging in a dream. At one point, he says that the state of which he writes no longer exists, perhaps never existed, and will probably never exist. Still, he left a way to dream that others picked up in centuries to come. The great 20th century French anthropologist, Claude Levi-Strauss, was just one of those who venerated and guarded the flame of Rousseau. Levi-Strauss once described him as our master and brother, and repeatedly demonstrated his feeling that the people who came after Rousseau were not worthy of him and had not honoured him enough. But, as a number of astute critics of both Rousseau and Levi-Strauss have pointed out, Rousseau did not glorify the state of nature simply for its own sake. He did so because he wanted to compare it with the Paris of his day, and to do so to the detriment of Paris. The noble savages were admirable to Rousseau, but more important is that they were useful. They were a foil for his jousts against the society he inhabited. Yet there were many people who took him at his word, among whom there were also some who came to regret it. In 1772, the French explorer Marc-Joseph Marion de Fresnay was on an expedition to New Zealand. One of his officers was Julien-Marie Crozet. These men were to varying extents still high on the theories of Rousseau and believed in the innocence of the state of nature. They had to learn the hard way what Rousseau had imagined the easy way. Marion de Fresnay and many of the ship's men were butchered in an apparently unprovoked Maori attack. The reverence of the survivors for Rousseau's theories did not survive this early encounter with the Maori people, who had not performed as Rousseau had expected them to. Yet the tendency to extol all non-Westerners survived Rousseau and Marion de Fresnay. In the 20th century, the vogue for using non-Western natives as a means to criticize the West has continued. If anything, it has sped up, with the added oddity that by now so much of what had been asserted in centuries past not merely was provably wrong, but also could be seen to be insultingly naive. Perhaps inevitably, the tendency thrived especially in academia. For instance, in the late 1980s, a professor at the University of Kansas could still be found waxing lyrical about non-Western native peoples. Writing about the Maori people, Alan Hansen could not resist comparing them with white people, specifically white Western people in New Zealand. In a paper in American Anthropologist, which inevitably cited Said's Orientalism, Hansen wrote that white people have lost the appreciation for magic and the capacity for wonder. What was more, he asserted, white culture is out of step with nature and pollutes the environment and lacks a close tie with the land. In a 2001 work, the dissenting Australian academic Roger Sandow sent up this strain of thinking, correctly identifying it as having an especially strong hold in his own country as it weathered the debates over its own history. At the opening of his 2001 book, The Culture Cult, Designer Tribalism and Other Essays, Sandow relayed the story of the actress and ex-model Lauren Hutton, who a few years earlier had taken her two young sons with her to visit the Maasai in Africa. Among their adventures, she took the children to see a witch doctor. Their mother tasted the witch doctor's potions, and the family then saw a cow being slaughtered and watched the red-robed Maasai warriors drinking the blood from its carcass. Hutton herself was enthralled by the whole thing, apparently accompanying these rituals with cries of "Wow!" The children, by contrast, appeared to have been traumatized for life. Neither of them smiled, and one of them burst into tears. Hutton had defended her decision by saying that she wanted her westernized children to learn a form of enlightenment from their visit to the Maasai vision seeker. Naturally, these things are more attractive to dip into than they are to live in. But that lesson has gone unlearned for many Western anti-Westerners, and the trend still persists. It is a trend that, as Sandal writes, yearns for romantic simplicity and a radical simplification of modern life. This perspective takes a sour view of modernity, and in the process forgets the benefits that modern Western civilization has conceived, created, and exported. It may be amazing to visit the Maasai, but how many people want to go raise cattle with them in Tanzania? How many immigrants head voluntarily into their tribe? Would they even be allowed? As Sandal said, the achievements of modern Western civilization are far from insignificant. They include, though are not limited to, a system that allows changes of government without bloodshed, civil rights, economic benefits, religious toleration, and political and artistic freedom. The alternatives to Western civil society do not enjoy or perpetuate any of these things to any significant extent. As Sandal wrote, most traditional cultures feature domestic repression, economic backwardness, endemic disease, religious fanaticism, and severe artistic constraints. Just for starters. Yet the appeal of everywhere but home will not die. By the last decade, it has become so common as to have become cliché that whenever a Western writer is in search of a ready-made answer to their critique of everything in the West, there is always a tribe somewhere just waiting to impart some homespun wisdom that can be repackaged, commodified, and sold in its turn by some wily anti-capitalist. Such writers present the native well as being extraordinarily deep, no matter how shallow it actually is. Popular films and television series continuously fall into the same trap, showing Western white society in all its flaws and then some new ones, while the life of native peoples outside the West is presented as an Elysian world, full of truths that Westerners can only dream about. The popular series White Lotus, 2021, offered a characteristic example of this. All the rich white Westerners in the HBO series are unhappy and empty, while the world of the native Hawaiians is held out as a vision of Edenic truthfulness the Westerners can only dream of accessing. Another fine recent example of this trend was presented by Naomi Klein in her 2017 book, No Is Not Enough, Defeating the New Shock Politics. There, Klein presented a vision of a West in utter crisis, brought on principally by the dominance of capitalism and the absence of socialism. But Klein is not only general. She can also be specific. For instance, after 250 pages of searing critique of Western capitalism, she has several answers for how to fix what she terms the corporate coup described in these pages in all its dimensions, a crisis with global reverberations that could echo through geologic time, as opposed to any other sort of time. But Klein has answers, too. We need to do more to create liberated cities for migrants and refugees, she says at one point. But as she struggles for ideas or practical conclusions, you can just sense where she is going to head to find the answers she needs. Inevitably, at this point, we learn of Brave Bull Allard, the official historian of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. Klein calls her the legendary Lakota elder Ladona Brave Bull Allard, who opened a camp on her land called Sacred Stone Camp. Klein is transfixed. Rousseau himself might have balked at her descriptions. Eyes still sparkling, betraying not a bit of fatigue, despite playing den mother to thousands of people who had come from across the world to be part of this historic movement. Her camp is for indigenous youth, but also for non-indigenous people who realized that the movement called for skills and knowledge most of us don't have. And what can people learn here as they escape from the capitalist West at this spot of sacred wisdom? My grandkids can't believe how little some of the white people know, Brave Bull Allard tells Klein, who describes her saying this, laughing, but without judgment. Then, presumably still laughing non-judgmentally, Brave Bull Allard tells a besotted Klein, "They come running. Grandma, the white people don't know how to chop wood. Can we teach them?" I say, "Yes, teach them." Brave Bull Allard herself patiently taught hundreds of visitors what she considers basic survival skills, including how to keep warm in the winter. The thermostat does not feature. But it is not just Brave Bull Allard who has such wisdom to teach the white man. Other members of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Council have done their bit too,